big issues. And hopefully, at least three out of the five come to some type of conclusion or conclusion-like understanding of those issues. Specifically, what we hope to, by the end of today, is have an idea of the approach to the issue of one, a couple who, let's say, found out that they're definitely carrying a child with Tay-Sachs disease or with Down syndrome. Is that a reason to allow abortion? That's question number one. Question number two is embryonic stem cell research, which involves taking either the leftovers, quote-unquote, of in vitro treatments and using that for research, obviously destroying the embryos. Or can you even lechatchila produce these embryos for the purpose of research, which everybody acknowledges is fantastic, fantastic research. And the third question that we'll hopefully have an answer to finally today is pre-implantation selection, meaning the following three types of issues. If a couple, Leinu, has a situation where there's a very good chance through natural means that will end up with a very defective newborn, can they go and have an in vitro procedure that then allows them to select some of the embryos that might not be afflicted with the particular condition, and then, of course, discard the other ones? Can you pick a boy over a girl? Can you do that? Let's say you want to have a son. Even for the purpose of having a fulfillment of the mitzvah per revu, is there a heter to do that? What have the poskim said about it? So all these issues involve our discussion. What I gave you out just now, which is also very... who just came in? Somebody go down. Okay. Just the right number. I have one extra. Gotcha. I don't need it. You have an extra? No. So I wanted you to see, this is coming out of the RCA, when the, you know, this is a very, very controversial, debated topic in the United States, but all over the world, whether the government should fund these embryonic stem cell research. So the RCA threw in their 2 cents. And I underlined what I thought is the central debatable issue, which was their conclusion that we believe it is entirely appropriate to utilize for this research, meaning the embryonic stem cell research, existing embryos, such as those created for IVF purposes, that would otherwise be discarded but for this research. We think it another matter to create embryos ab initio for the sole purpose of conducting this form of research. So we want to understand that line. We want to understand how the RCA comes to that split decision. So we left off discussing really and understanding the status of a fetus, and in particular the attitudes, the extreme attitudes of Rav Moshe Feinstein versus Rav Oldenburg, versus Eliezer, towards abortion. And we started off by looking at what's going to come out to be three or four main sugyot that they debate in coming to their conclusions. Rav Moshe, we saw, is focused on the issue that when it comes to a ben Noach, he's chayv misa for abortion, and there is a klal, mi'ika midi d'shari le Yisrael and usher to a ben Noach. Can there be anything that is really mutter to a Jew that's usher to a non-Jew? And based on that klal, Rav Moshe starts off in the Tosfos that we saw in Sanhedrin, that not only is there an isser in abortion, but there's clearly in his mind, an iser tzicha involved. That it's just as bad as killing a live-born infant, minus the onish. That's the only thing that's different. There's no onish misa. But all the other ramifications of a chiyav tzicha, an iser tzicha, are in place. Yarek val yavor. And we saw, when we went to the next raya of Rav Moshe, the other major, major nafkamina, which is the only thing that could be matir, the iser tzicha, is a rodef, a situation of a rodef. That's where I'm allowed to kill somebody if I see that he's a rodef. So, based on that, Rav Moshe develops what is the most machmir approach to the shiloh of abortion. Then, in analyzing the Rambam, which is where we'll start right now, page 4, We come across with what is one of the most controversial Rambam. Rambam that's very puzzling and has about 20 different responses. Just to remind everybody, we were dealing with the Mishnah in Ohalos that describes two situations. Situation number one is prenatal. It's taking place with a fetus who is considered stuck in labor. The mother is stuck in labor, and because of this, she's going to die unless we do something to stop it. So the Mishnah tells us, in that case, we are allowed to dismember, in the most gruesome way, the fetus to save her life. However, when is this true? That's only kodem leida, but the minute there is the first manifestation of being alive, being born, which there's a bit of a machlokus, even amongst the contemporary poskim, exactly when that moment is it rov harosh, is it rov hababy, and if it's a breech presentation, obviously then it has to be rov hababy, whatever it is, but at that moment, the baby is no longer a fetus, and is considered equal to the mother, and we will not be docher one nefesh for the other. Where things get very, very puzzling with the Rambam is in specifically two issues. Number one, he chooses, rather than take the approach of what seems to be Poshut Pshat in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, and the approach of Rashi, to say that the reason you're allowed to kill the fetus to save the mother is because when dealing with a non-nefesh Gemara, a nefesh that's less viable than the mother's, and that is what gives the mother the edge over the fetus and allows us to destroy the fetus in order to save the mother. That's question number two. We'll get to that in a second. Question number one, though, is this whole idea that you need rodef. It seems to be a chiddush altogether. Because the Rambam is the single, he's not the single, there's actually two other dolim that agree with the Rambam, right? I think the Sefer Chinuch says the same thing, but the Rambam is bringing in rodef when it seems totally unnecessary. It seems to go beyond Pashut Pshat. Pashut Pshat is, it's a Nefesh Sheina Gemurah, there's no reason I shouldn't be Docha that Nefesh for the Nefesh of the mother. But the Rambam clearly and twice emphasizes that the reason that you're allowed to kill the fetus is only because of Rodev. Question number two is exactly what you said. What's the difference in the second situation? That baby now is a Rodev. So if Rodev allows us to kill the fetus, what's the difference once it's live birth? So the Gemara in Sanhedrin gave us an answer. Oh, you know what the difference, you know what the issue is? After birth, d'mishamaya karadfi. That really, we're going to view this as not a true rodef. There's no kavana of this baby that's born to kill the mother. It's mina shamayim. In the words of the Rambam, v'zeu tibo shalola. What's the obvious problem with just saying that? Why don't we say the same thing for the fetus? It's also not the fetus's intention to kill his mother. Is it a tibo shalolam then too? So the second question is, what changed? How did we go from being rodef to suddenly being mishamayim karati? What's the difference? So again, two questions. Why does the Rambam need rodef altogether? Once he uses it, why is it only applicable in the fetal case but not in the born baby case? So we saw that Rav Moshe favors his own understanding of this issue and he favors Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim answers it, as we mentioned last time, the following way. When it comes to the din of rodef, it really involves two parts. There is the chiyuv on the rodef, and the din hatsala on the nirdaf. That's what normally is involved in every time there's a din of it's mutter to kill the rodef. And the Rambam goes out of his way, when you look at the piece, to show this isn't just the din of bikuach nefesh, b'kola tera kula. This is a din d'fnei atzma, the din of rodef, it's a chiddush. And it involves these two halakim. What happens in the case of the shabaya karadfila? What happens in the case of where there's no kavana really? There's not a rodef in the sense that we have a live person who's miskaven to go kill another person, like our case. So we lose one of those two pieces. Which piece do we lose? The chiyuv harodef. He's not really chayiv misa. He's not like doing anything. It's totally beyond his control. What's left? The din of Hatzalas and Nirbah.
There's a din hatzalah nirdaf that never gets knocked off. Okay, but is it enough to justify killing? Is hatzalah nirdaf alone without the chiyuv harodef enough? So that's the chas, the Rav Chaim. It's enough when you're dealing with an uva, but it's not enough when you're dealing with a live-born baby. And that's the chiyuv. What comes out of this that Rav Moshe favors is clearly you still needed this din of hatzalas hanirdaf to justify killing the ubar. Just a din of pikuach nefesh was not enough. Just the fact that this is a lav nefesh gemura wouldn't have worked without this halacha of hatzalas hanirdaf. It kind of it perhaps fits in with that Tosfos we saw when we in Sanhedrin Nutas, where the Tosfos had mentioned, why don't we have a problem of the mi ika midi in this case, right? Because a ben Noach presumably, even, and this is halach lemaisa according to many the psak, a ben Noach even in the danger of the life of the mother is not permitted to kill the uba, right? It's machlokes, but many people hold this way. Lahalacha, a ben Noach can't kill the fetus, have an abortion to save the mother's life. Because the Torah views the Ben Noach as treating this nefesh as an Adam. It's an Adam betoch Adam, and this Adam, the fetus, has the same rights to life as the mother. So Tosfos had asked, why don't we say mi'ikamidi there? We're allowed to dismember the baby, right? But the Ben Noach, for the sake of the mother, can't destroy the fetus. How could that be? Mutter for us, aser for Ben Noach. So Tosfos had answered, right? Anyone remember what was Tosfos' answer? He went back to the principle that he started the Tosfos with, which is what is an exception in general to the din of mi'ika midi, that Ben Noach is aser and Yisrael is mutter? He said, ishani when it's a mitzvah. And perhaps, if I wanted to develop this into some type of shir, I would say, oh, he's talking about Reb Chaim's din, of the mitzvah of Hatzalos HaNirdaf. That's what he's referring to. That's the mitzvah. Putting all that aside, the bottom line is, you come out of Rav Moshe, again, maintaining that you need this Hatzalos HaNirdaf because there's an Isser Tzicha that's going on. How would the Tzitz Eliezer deal with this Rambam? Is he going to concede that the Rambam agrees with Rav Moshe? Not at all. Totally not. Because there are many, many other answers to the two Shilas in the Rambam, three of which the Tzitz Eliezer chooses to present. Number one, perhaps the most partial is the Achiezer. The Achiezer says, look at the case. The case is Ha'isha Shehi Mikasha Leila. What does that mean? What's going on? She's in
labor.
Things have begun to happen. What happens when labor begins? Anyone ever experienced labor?
Not
I meant as a helpful support, right? What happens when labor begins is we say the baby ne'akar, meaning the baby, right? And there's several expressions for this. The baby is released to some degree. The baby is not considered the same intact uvar, but now the baby might be gufa achrina, no longer yerech imo. Once labor begins and the process of exiting begins, even prior to full exit and becoming a born, there's a step in between. There's this freed up ubar. So the Achiezer says that's the only reason Rodef is needed by the Rambam. Because we're in labor and we got to the point of the ubar is freed. But otherwise, what does the Achiezer say? If it wasn't that part, it was free labor, then in Achinami the Rambam would not need Rodef at all. So that fits nicely for the Tzitz Eliezer Shita, but it would be difficult to apply it Lamaisa, so then at labor things changed. It's not a popular shita. There are two other answers, though.
Why is that difficult to apply?
I guess it isn't difficult to apply. It's just difficult to imagine that it is applied. Stages. There's any other makaras that support that there's a chiluk that happens at the moment of labor, and that before it, however, you don't need to be a real deal. The Rambam certainly is, I wouldn't say chaser yikam mina sefer, but the Rambam's not formulating it that way specifically. The Rambam seems to say that we can kill the ubar because it's a rodev. But in the case of the born baby, it's divo shalol. But what happened to the in-between case? He should be giving us all the details. That's the difficulty with the Achiezer's pshat to some degree. Then there is the Tiferes Tzvi. Tiferes Tzvi makes the following point. He says, even if you're going to hold, let's say you hold that this ubar is really of no significance in terms of being a nefesh. Does that mean the ubar is of no significance? What minimally is an ubar? According to Chumash, right? Everyone knows the parsha deals with the asong occurring. Two people are fighting, and then the pregnant woman gets hit, right? And then the Torah talks about an asong and an asong, right? Some type of calamity occurs. What's the non? The calamity is if the woman would die. The non-calamity is if just loses, she miscarries, right? And what's the din in that setting? What if she miscarries? What's the din? Right. Pay the father. So minimally, l'chodeos. You want to say an ubar is not an ashama at all. It's a nothing. But minimally, it's mamon haba. What is the din when it comes to pikuach nefesh and mamon acher? Are you allowed, with impunity, to save your life with the mamon that belongs to somebody else? What's the din? Anyone know? Choshen Mishpat. Right? This is in Taf Nun Tes, Choshen Mishpat. Dalet. The din is, you cannot save your life with mamon acherim, right? Al pialach it's gzela, right? It's on the hilchos gzela. You are not allowed to do that. However, we of course don't want you to die. So it's mutter, depending on payback. You're chayav to pay back. To save your life, okay, use the mamon, steal it, right? But you got to pay it back. If you can't pay it back, that's a problem.
This is just a side point. It sounds very close to Heinz's dilemma.
Right.
Where you have to, like...
Does anything justify...
Right.
So, hold the thought for a second, because we're going to get closer to Heinz in a minute. That's halacha number one that the Teferet Tzvi mentions.
Then he says something else. There's a Gemara in Bava Kama, Adaf Kuf Yud Zayin, which is also brought down the halacha. I think it's Shin Pei in Choshen Mishpat, where it says the following. There was a Svina, a boat, that was out, getting ready to go out to sea, goes out to sea, and somebody, without permission, brings their donkey onto the boat. And that donkey was going to be responsible for the sinking of this boat. So somebody on the boat tossed it overboard. Just tossed it. To save his life. And save the lives of everybody on the boat. Did he do the right thing? So, according to the halacha we just said, maybe not. Right? Unless maybe he'll pay back. Does he have to pay back? So the halacha is no. In that case, you don't have to pay back. Why not? So the Gemara says, because it's like a rodef, or a grama, it's a gorem. The donkey was the gorem for the sakana. If somebody's mamon is the gorem for the sakana, then you can just get rid of it and have no responsibility to pay back. So the Teferet Tzvi, everyone see where this is going? He takes these halachos and he applies it to this case. He says, look, minimally, this ubar is mamon of the father. So, true, to save the life of the mother, we certainly can kill this lesser being, this pure mamon, non-neshama. However, the din is, you can't just for free, with no excuse, be ma'aved somebody's mamon legamre, because there won't be any paying back. It'll be very difficult to pay back. He's being ma'aved legamre. So he says that's why the Rambam needs to come on to the concept of rodef. Rodef, in the sense of that gore, the way that donkey was a rodef on the boat, in Kufi Zayin Bamakama, that's the way this ubar is treated. And therefore, that's what the Rambam means. He doesn't mean rodef behilchas ritzicha, like Moshe says. He means like a ker rodef. And he emphasizes, you'll see in the Rambam, he uses a chaf, this is ke rodev, not rodev. And therefore, again, he gets out of the entire compelling need, like Rav Moshe has, to say this is a din in Ritzicha, and all you have is a very low-level fetus. And we need rodev only because of this other din of you can't be ma'ade, mamon kavercha, without any type of paper. And then Tzitzi Eliezer gives one more response. He says, the Gaonei Basrai said, look at the description of the abortion taking place in this case. It's gruesome. Horrible. It says we're going to dismember the fetus limb by limb. He says that's why you need rodent. To just kill the fetus the way a compassionate doctor would do,
in our time, so then you wouldn't have needed Rabin, because it isn't gruesome and horrible. But the tzura of the killing of the fetus, that's what warranted Rodef as an issue. It's only because he's a Rodef that you can get away with such a horrible type of killing. What's the common denominator between all these answers? So the Tzitzel Eliezer maintains that they all are focused on avoiding what Rav Moshe concludes, avoiding that there's an Isser Ritzicha going on, right? Rodef here is in a different category of the conventional Rodef, and he will maintain that the Rambam does not consider the Isser of abortion Ritzicha. And he even presses by saying that that whole issue of Mi'ika Midi, the first point that Rav Moshe makes, the Rambam doesn't even paskin that way. The Rambam paskins, we don't hold by that klal at all. He quotes a Chasim Sofer and others that maintain this, that the Rambam doesn't even assume that such a klal exists, or at least it wasn't accepted halacha. So far in the major sugyot, we can actually understand how we have these two extremes. You turn the page, right, on top, by the way, there's the parsha from the Shvatim that we just talked about. One more sugi to look at, and then we're going to conclude the abortion sermon. This is a sugi that puts Rav Moshe on the defensive, and really is supportive in its pashtus of the Tzitzel Eliezer. Sugi in Erchim. The Mishnah says the following. Ha'isha shiyatza liharek, a woman who is going to be executed. Ein mamtinin la ad shetelet. She's pregnant. What do? She's guilty of murder. She is going out to be executed. What about the fetus? Did the fetus kill anybody? Anyone have a response to that? Did the fetus kill anyone?
That's Eric Yerahimel.
Yeah, good.
Perhaps the fetus did. We have a statement of Rava that just like the mother did the mice in the Gicha, so the Ubar did the mice in the Gicha when it's talking about a shore. How far do we carry that, right?
So it sounds like we carry it pretty far. Because look at the Gemara.
Well, let me just finish the next line of the Mishnah. So the second line of the Mishnah is, that's the case of the woman, right, who's not in labor, she's pregnant, ein mamtinin la ad shetelet. She gets executed, and along with her, the fetus. Ha'isha shiyashva al hamishpar, but a woman who goes into labor, that's what that expression means, she's on the birth stool, mamtinin la ad shetelet. In that case, we wait. What's the difference? Why, before labor, we execute her and the fetus? Once labor begins, then we gotta wait. Based on what we just said a few minutes ago?
I was just gonna say that maybe because the baby could possibly come out while right before during the execution, so then you'd have some issues.
Okay, that's not bad. That's not bad, but.
Let's look at the Gemara. The Gemara, I'm just going to read a few lines. The Gemara says, why is it, the underlying question of the Gemara is, why is it that we don't wait for this woman to give birth in the first case? So the Gemara says, pshita gufahi. Ooh, wow. What does that sound like? Pshita gufahi. Sounds like ubar yarachima, right? It sounds like the way most Rishonim learn it. Ubar yarachima. What's going on here is... the Gemara took for granted, Pashut, we would not wait for this baby to be born, and the baby should be executed, because, what is it? It's an Ubar Ziyarachimo, that's all it is. And part of the Maiser Ritzicha, whatever got this woman, the Chi of Nisa, right? When the Psak Din came down, it came down on the Ubar as well as the mother. So the Gemara is asking, Pshita, why do I even need to be told this? So the answer is, Itzdrich. Satcha datcha mina hoel uksiv kasher yashit alav bal ha'isha ramona de balhu l'listedin. Why is it needed to be recorded in the Mishnah? Because it was a havamina, despite the fact that ubayach imo, it was a havamina that I still would not execute this baby, the fetus, because minimally, again, it's mamon bal. And why should he lose out? Because his wife's chayav misa, we should, you know, take away his mamon. So then the Gemara says, "Kamashlan that we, nevertheless, despite the fact that it's mamon baal, we're going to execute." The Eimal Chanami, the Gemara asks, "Well, why don't we worry about mamon baal?" So that's Zeres HaKosim. Omar Rebbe Yavau, Omar Yochel, Omar Kra, Umesu Gam Shnehem, L'Rabos Esavlad. We have Zeres HaKosim to tell me, don't worry about Mamam Baal, but just take out the fetus and don't worry about it. You know, execute the mother and let the fetus go. Later on, the Gemara says, Yashva ala mishbar, my tama, why is it any different once she's in labor? Labor, kevan da akar, gufa achrinahu, like we just said, right? What's different in the second case? Once labor begins, akar, it's uprooted from its ubar yerch imo status, now it's considered gufa achrina, and now we have to wait. So, who does this support, the Moshe or the Volman?
This Gemara.
What does it sound? Sounds very much like the Volman, right? Because, number one, what's the mouth? We have a woman who's going to be executed, and along with her, this baby will die. Do we have any obligation to save that fetus? So, the Gemara seems to say, no. But why not? Why don't we save the baby anyway? Okay, so we don't have to. Like, wouldn't it be the right thing to do? So the Rishonim explained there's another issue here. And that is that if we, what would happen to the mother if we delayed things? She'd be suffering tremendously. It's the inoy of waiting for her execution. It would be such pain and suffering that for the sole purpose, right? This is the Tosfos on the top of the daf over there who spells this out. But in order to help her avoid that suffering, that's why we're not going to delay it, even though it would have been nice to save the fetus, right? But we're not going to do it, because for her suffering, it's not worth it. What's the implication of that straight out? And Rav Waldenberg will use this. We'll say, look, what do we see black and white? For the suffering, not the sakana, not the pikuach nefesh of the mother, right? But just to help her avoid this type of suffering, the inui hadin, the inui of waiting for the execution, we're going to allow a baby to die. Now, that's not the same as saying what? It's not the same as a proactive abortion. It's more like a sheva altas, allowing of an execution. That's one, that's the beginning of a response. What else could Rav Moshe say in response to this? Rav Moshe could say, and he does, and the others that also don't want to be maskim, that this is a raya, that just for the suffering of the mother you can permit abortion, there's a chi of misa here. We can't ignore ubar yarech imo is a klal, and this fetus has an execution over its head. It's not like your average innocent everyday fetus. This is a fetus who's chayv misa along with the mother. So in that setting, right, only in that setting, because of the inui hadin thrown in, then we will have the sheval taseh. But another fetus who doesn't have a din of misa hanging over its head, we would never allow it just for the suffering of the mother. That would be the response. And then Rav Moshe, which I haven't quite understood, and I looked at the tshuva many, many times to try to see exactly what he's saying, I have difficulty remembering. Rav Moshe also throws in the gzeiras hakasa. He says, and there's another thing here. We have Xeris Akasav to include the Vlad, right? But to me, pshat in this Gemara, and I appreciate anyone who can explain to me what I'm doing wrong here. Pshat in this Gemara, what it said, the Xeris Akasav was what? Certainly the way I led you. Look at it on your own. To me, that's talking about the Mamon Baal element, and that's it. That's the issue of the Xeris Akasav. Why can I ignore the fact that I'm going to be mafsid the Baal because of this Xeris HaKosim? Somehow Rav Moshe brings it in for the more fundamental issue. How can I allow the execution of the fetus altogether? Okay, so at the end of the day, these are the major Gemaras that the two Gedolim base their Shita on. Now, they're at extremes. So extreme number one is Rav Moshe, that the Isser in destroying a fetus is an Isser of Mitzvah. At the other extreme is the Tzitz Eliezer. He ends up saying, not only is it not Mitzvah, it is not an Isser D'Oraisa Bichlal, it's only Asa Midrabanan. In between are several other Shittos. That there is an Issa D'Oraisa,
But it's not Ritzicha. We have the Maharitz, the Chavos Yair, and then miscellaneous. The Maharitz says there's an Isser of Chavala. That's the Isser. Chavala to whom? Who's getting Chavala here? Two, possibly two people, right? The M, the Aim, the mother, or the Ubar. The Chavos Yair says Hashchata Zera. That's the Isser, right? Many disagree with this, right? Because what? Hashchata Zera might only apply mamish to Zera, but not to a situation where there's already, you know, a fertilized being. That's not considered Hashchata Zera. We'll see, this is going to be a very important sheet. And then there's a shita of Hatzalah, that we're chayev to be matzil a fetus based on what? Lotama da Hamra.
What's this about born? How can you call your reacha if it's still part of the mother? Does it have a separate life?
Because the potential life is enough to grant it the status of reacha. We'll see in a minute the proof of that. Okay? These five shitas, if you want to organize a way of understanding all the issues that we're about to answer, those three questions, all you have to do is remember these five shitas and apply logic. I'll show you what I mean. Let's start with our first question. Down syndrome and taste sense. Is it mutter to have an abortion for Down syndrome or a taste sense? According to Rav Moshe, what would be the only thing that could be matir tzicha? You said it. Rodef, right? Anything short of rodef, even pikuach nefesh alone is not enough. Pikuach nefesh is not doche tzicha. For Rav Moshe, you need mamish that the fetus is a rodef. In the case of Down syndrome or Tay-Sachs, is anything like that going on? Absolutely not. Everybody understands what Down syndrome and Tay-Sachs disease is, right? Tay-Sachs is a horrible disease. They're not exactly the same. The issues are a little different. We'll see where they separate. But Tay-Sachs is a disease where, at most, the child would live to 3 or 4, most of the life being horribly suffering, for at least at the end of the second year of life, really a horrible existence. Horrible for the family, horrible for the infant. But none of that is rodef. None of that. What about chavala? What could be matir chavala? Pikuach nefesh for sure, right? Pikuach nefesh would be matir. This is the matir. Pikuach nefesh. Anything else? Anyone ever get a vaccination? Yes. So what else could be matir chavala? Even something like refuah, right? We can get chavala if it's refuah.
At least you draw blood for people with leeches, like that kind of thing.
Whatever.
Is
right? Bloodletting, certainly. What?
Is there a limit to that? In terms of what extent of chavala?
No. You know, there's chavala and there's reticha. If you're not killing somebody, you're hurting them. If the refuah outweighs the chavala, that would be the way. Obviously, if the refuah is really a chavala and you're not helping anyone, then it's not chavala l'shem refuah. That's chavala. It would mean that you're getting more refuah than you are chavala.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that there is some type of drugs or medication that temporarily would make life horrible, but in the long term,
that's refuah.
That's a specific example.
What counts is what the ultimate benefit, the risk-benefit ratio. If the benefit outweighs the risk, that's a refuah. And that would be matir the chavala. What about Hashkata Zera? What could be Matir Hashkata Zera? Anyone know anything? Pikuach Nefesh, right? That's always going to be in there, right? Pikuach Nefesh. Anything else? Did you guys, I don't know how what I branded when we discussed these treatments, right? So the infertility treatments, one of the major issues by artificial insemination and in vitro fertilization is the issue of how to get the sperm, right? And is there an issur hashkata zera? So what do Rove Poskim hold? It's mutter, right?
It's going to be used.
Donor, husband, donor, it's certainly mutter. IVF, without all the mamzerus issues, right? It's mutter. Most postings hold it, right? Of all the merg happens to be machmir now. But why? Why is it in Ashkat Zera? Well, because it's to be the Mekayim, the mitzvah of Perugur. It's because what Waldenberg holds, that you're not Mekayim that mitzvah, right? That it leads to, hey, and it's also the Yisra of Ashkat Zera becomes a problem.
And was it wasted, though? I mean, they only need one sperm.
Right, so that's one of the Yonim. Right? That's one of the Yonim involved. In other words, if even during Zerach Hateva procreation, that happens, right? The only difference, this is where Waldenberg thinks, or feel like he says, but they're Hateva, most of the sperm are deposited inside, whereas in vitro they're not. He even favors artificial insemination over in vitro for that reason, and it's he'll say, what is Ashkat Zera, where it's all outside, otherwise not. But Rob Poskin will say, if the objective is towards Peruvu, and the it's required for the procedure, you know, you do what you have to do. There are some people that are machmir and say that, you know, what you should do, let's say in vitro, is you should make sure that you use all the sperm and surround the ovum with all the sperm at one time. That would be, it could be limiting in exactly how you make it work. But there's a chumrah like that, just so you don't have any wastage. But it is because of this mitzvah puravu that we won't call it Ashkat Zera. They could be, you know, very much the opposite relationship between those two. When it is Puravu, it's not Ashkat Zera, right? There's some that look at the din that way. What about Hatzala, Lotama Adam Reacha? What could be overriding that?
Really one thing.
Kuach Nefesh. What about Dinei Derabanan? Generally, Tzarech Gadol. Whatever that means, it's up to the road. Going down this whole list, who would be matir? Let's say a family comes forward and they say, we cannot handle having a baby with taste substances. We just can't handle it. This baby's just going to suffer. It's too much for us, and it's not fair to the baby. Who would be matir? The only shita here that really would be matter that would be Rav Oldenburg, and he is the one who does. But he differentiates a little between Down syndrome and Tay-Sachs. And mostly because Tay-Sachs has one further element to it that makes it open to more of a kula. What would that be?
Baby's going
to
die.
Right. Baby's going to die anyway. It's not considered viable. So that's why he will say when it comes to Down syndrome, he throws in a little bit of a chumrah. And he says, it's got to really be very case by case. You have to investigate the family and determine that they can't handle it. And this is a tsar for the entire family, for the mother especially. Then it constitutes a tzarech gadol enough that he would be matir, abortion of such a baby, as late as the 7th month. Why the 7th month? Anyone have an idea? Why does he pick the 7th month? That's a big chiddush, that 7th month. That like just knocks... Not me for a loop. What's special about 7?
That's the earliest time where it could be viable, no?
Yes. It's not true, right? It might have been originally at the time when he first wrote the Jew, but nowadays it's definitely moved down, right? But, correct, that's the reasoning. So that would have to be adjusted, bismanein. If that really is the issue, so we have fetuses, we have premature babies of 24 weeks, 25 weeks, which is a lot earlier, that are considered viable.
Is the hefter...
You next.
Who's next?
You're first.
Is the hetero that the parents cannot treat the child, or that the child will not be living a normal life?
Well,
I mean, just based on that, like any parents.
It's the tsar ha'en is the major hetero. The tsar that the mother and the tsarach gadol. The way I view. His expression here is, and he's very much thinking of the Sugin Erchen with the Inle Hadin, and that this is a din derabanan of a certain low level, where if there's tremendous tzorach based on a cumulative suffering of the entire family and the mother, and for a tesax you throw in the non viability, right? That's where they have to come from.
So, any
parents who put together, like, let's say...
So where do you draw the line?
Right.
He's very aware of that. And when you read through the Chubos, you know, he doesn't want anyone to think that he's, like, cavalier about this at all. You know, his Chubos go through an evolution, meaning he came up, the very first one is the Chelek Zion, it comes up as, like, a side statement to another Chuba. And then he got a response. Like, he let out this psalm, and he got a response, and then two Chubos later, first he goes to the Chelek and tells a little more, and then finally, in the text, there is the big Chuba, and he goes through all the Sugios, and then somebody writes, Moshe wrote his Chuba, which is diametrically opposed to everything he's saying. And someone wrote him and said, take a look at Moses' tshuva, what do you say to that? He writes back another one, right? This is like the fourth or fifth tshuva, defending himself against Rav Moshe. So at the end of the day, he says, but he quotes the Zohar, where the Zohar is very machmir against abortion. He says, I'm aware of the Zohar, and I know, and I don't want you to think I'm a cavalier. But he really stood his ground and said, this is how I understand all these sugyas that we were looking at last week and this week and the week before. I think this is the MS. I really, really do. And I can't, you know, when you're machmir about this end, you're going to, when you make yo about this end, you're being conscious of how you might be machmir about the other end. Meaning, the suffering that's going on, if he really holds that this ubar is insignificant, halachically, and that the din is, it's only a din d'rabbana, that you're not allowed to just kill ubarim, he feels that the right thing to do is not allow these people to suffer. I don't want the family to suffer. I don't want this child to suffer. It would be better to be doche the din d'rabbanan. And he does point out that you have to be, you know, very careful who's paskining such shilas. I have to say that I was caught by surprise when I started getting visits from patients who were asking me to do things that I normally do only in the setting of somebody who's thinking along the lines of maybe doing an abortion, right? Certain tests that are not really indicated for a normal pregnancy. And I was seeing from people, and they were telling me they're Rabbanim are, I think, more, this is anecdotal, I have no proof that this is true, but my own observation is that Rabbanim are more leaning towards the Tzitzel Ezer than they have been in the past. So definitely a sheet to be aware of. Okay, so that's, in terms of Down syndrome and Tay-Sachs, that's really where the heter lies. Any other shita is going to be machmir. There's no pikuach nefesh. It's very far-fetched, right, to assume that there's real psychological ramifications to these type of births that could be pikuach nefesh. People are very, very hesitant to grant that. So that if you're really holding along any of these shitos, that's going to be a tough one to squeeze through. Did you get to ask your question?
If the baby with
Tay-Sachs
can live up to a couple years, why is it considered
non-viable? Well, it's... In terms of Chayei Olam, Chayei Olam is defined as a year. By that definition, this baby has Chayei Olam. If you didn't have Chayei Olam, there would be a lot more kulas about the situation.
So when you say non-viable, what...
In other words, it's destined to die for sure in a very finite period of 2 years. It isn't, right, it isn't like a chai shah heter. If that's what you're bothered by, you're correct. There is, say again?
And where do we see this class?
We don't. In other words, it's an extrapolation. It's an extrapolation of the notion of chai shah that gives it an edge over, a cooler edge over Down syndrome. But it isn't the garden being used in terms of formulating this psalm.
Is it an extrapolation of Chayesha, or are we dealing also with the suffering of the child? So I understand. Is that a Down syndrome child doesn't suffer? Parents may suffer.
Right, but it's a separate element, though, I think. I think, like, by Tay-Sachs, there's two elements.
Right.
There's the suffering of the child, which is taking place, you know, from years 2 to 4 or 5. And then it seems to be an additional element, and I don't have a biblical for it. He throws it in that this, it's really the Mishnas of Ram. In understanding the different tzah of the Tzitzel Ezer, the kind of Down syndrome, the kind of Tay-Sachs. Because by Down syndrome, he says, we better investigate and make sure we're careful. Tay-Sachs is more absolute, that this is a heter. What's the difference between the two is that by Tay-Sachs, the fact that it's a non-viable in terms of 4 years, but you're right, as terms of a halach precedent that recognizes 4 years of life is any less than 70, you're correct.
I agree with you, but it was like a sniff the hot dog. I didn't feel I had it before.
Is there an extreme case where you call it or fool it for the mother?
Yes. Exactly what he's doing.
So even for the
he says that.
Even for the Mahari, you can say you're fool is the head.
Oh, you mean like in terms of Kabbalah?
Yeah.
That's a bit of a stretch. I mean, in terms of like, this is mamish an act of refuah. I mean, I hear what you're saying. It's not absurd. Definitely, I haven't seen anyone entertain that approach.
I think it's a little too much to say. But that's mamish refuah. From her psychological dilemma, now she's going to be depressed afterwards also. It's not going to be a pleasant experience no matter what. So I don't know if it's mamish refuah in that sense.
Questions. One is,
I want to make sure I finish this so I can get to the new area.
What does the Zohar exactly say about abortion? And second of all, what is the 40-day time period have anything to do with it?
If you look in the, I don't know the exact wording of the Zohar, the upshot of the Zohar is
who is it that is brings an end to the world? People that commit abortions, that type of lashon.
That's like a horrible description. It reminded me of the shita when we did the kaparos. Remember by the kaparos, we were talking about how many chickens? So whose shita was you have to take three? Remember somebody had a shita, one for the mother, a zacha and a nekeva, for the boy and the girl, really implying that they viewed the ubar as an independent entity completely. It was the ari. Maybe it's not a coincidence, right?
But the Zohar comes out very, very striking against abortion.
So it's a very, Hashkach Zohar, also the Zohar is very, very strong as that.
Against
it. Interesting. But with the 40 days, the 40-day time period, anything to do with
that? Yes, that's what I want to get to. I'm going to just sneak a little over the 4 o'clock deadline just so I can finish this topic. All right. I'm going to erase this now, and we're going to put something else in. The two other issues that are very, very significant in terms of looking at this whole thing. How do we know that there's a din hatzal in a fetus? You asked, right? What would be a raya if there's a din hatzal? What din? I'll tell you. The din of pikuach nefesh doche Shabbos. If I am chayiv, we're allowed to be doche Shabbos, right? To save a fetus, that clearly and unequivocally expresses that there is a din hatzala by that fetus. Because if there wasn't, if I was allowed to just let a fetus die, that was mutter, or even worse, kill the fetus, it would be absurd to say that there's a heter of chilul Shabbos. And Rav Moshe uses that in a very significant way. We'll see in a minute. And just to let you know, in terms of the issue of can I be mechalel Shabbos for a fetus? So it's a famous machlokes rishonim, machronim. It's worth getting into it. I was going to get into it, but I'm just going to give you the end result is, for the most part, we paskin that you can. Right? You can be doche Shabbos just for the fetus. Even if there's no danger to the mother, right? You can be doche Shabbos for a fetus. Why is that important? 40 days. This is contemporary science's understanding of the stages of fetal life. This is just one to show you that Chazal did very well with this. These are called what? Sperm and an egg. What are they called? Begins with a G? Gametes. They get together, fertilized. That first fertilized cell is called a zygote. The zygote cleaves, right? It's about to split into many, many different cells. This is called pre-embryo. Well, blastus, that's one of the stages. Very good. Who said that? Okay. That's 4 cells, et cetera, et cetera. But the group from the first cleavage of that very first zygote, it's called pre-embryo, up until 2 things happen. Implantation in the uterus, right? Till now, where is it? It's in the fallopian tube, floating around, right? Fertilizing. Cleaving, and then sometime later, a few days later, about a week or so later, implantation and a streak appears in this embryo, which will be the neural tube, And at this point, we call it an embryo. Two things needed: that primitive streak, which now makes this into an individual, right? Before now, it could still be twins, it could be triplets, it could split up. Now it's committed to being one individual, and it's implanted in the uterus. About 7 to 8 weeks later, it's no longer called an embryo. It's called a fetus. So that's day, let's say, 49 to 56. What's the difference between an embryo and a fetus? What happens, according to contemporary science, by this time? It is now an individual that has all the different organ systems differentiated and formed. They still need a little more perfection over the course of the next 32 weeks or so. But at this point, according to modern science, there is a formed fetus. So if you look at the last page of the handout, we see Chazal did very well. Chazal said, Amar Achista Hare Amar Yitzira Savlat Be'isha Arbaim Yom. They were way, way ahead of contemporary science. This was relatively recent on a scale compared to the Gemara of an understanding for contemporary science. Right around here is where Yitzira Savlat was, according to Chazal, and it's really very close to the way contemporary medicine understands it as well. Why is that important? Well, if you look at the sugyas on page 6, and I'll just mention them outside, because there's significant nafkaminas for this 40-day period. Unlike the 7-month that Rav Waldenberg throws out, which doesn't have any makor in Shas, this does. 40 days is the period of Yetzirah Savlad, and it's the period where no longer is this embryo referred to as Maya Ba'alma. Maya Ba'alma with many nafkaminas la'alach. For example, if a woman miscarries prior to 40 days, there's no tumas leda, there's no chiv korban. And the other major nafkamina that's on the page over there, a bas kohen who gets married to Yisroel. And right after a week of marriage, the Yisroel dies. So normally if she's pregnant and known to be pregnant, with let's say 3 months pregnant, can she eat truma, pregnant from the Yisroel? No, she cannot eat truma. A pregnant bas kohen, who's pregnant from Yisrael even after he dies, she cannot eat truma. What about if the scenario was the way I presented it? That they got married, it was a maisa bia, and then he died. So the Gemara says, for the first 40 days, no problem, she can eat truma. Why? Because, number one, she might not be pregnant. Even if she is, maya ba'alma, we don't care. So, and there are other sugyas. I'm not going to start listing all the different sugyas, but the Gemara considered the first 40 days maya ba'alma. So here's the question. Does it make a difference, halacha l'maisa, in terms of abortion? So again, the trick is to look at the 5 shittos. Will it make a difference for Ritzicha? Is there anything wrong with being killing maya ba'alma? Presumably not. No one knows for sure. Presumably not. Presumably even Rav Moshe is moda that there's no issa ritzicha less than 40 days. So we'll say no. Chavala? Well, there's no ritzicha, right? There's no chavala of blood, that's for sure. What might there be? Chavala sahen. Okay, so we still have to worry about that. How about tashchat zera? For sure, yes, right? That's going to be the one that sticks out all the way through. See, even when it comes to the most modern question. How about Hatzalah? What did I tell you it will depend on? Whether there's a Din Hatzalah or not. What does it depend on? What's the indicator? What's the indicator whether there's a Din Hatzalah? Can I be Michal Shabbos or not? Right? So, the overwhelming consensus is I can be Michal Shabbos for a embryo even prior to 40 days. Right? Start with Bahag, maybe Shonim say it, and it's brought down halacha that, for the most part, with some exceptions in mind, Avram that doesn't agree, but for the most part, the opinion is that yes, even prior to 40 days, there is a din of you can be Machal Shabbos to save that Umbar. So, Hatzala, yes. What about the Yisrael Rabbanan? It's going to be really no different. He was Mekel even post 40 days, right? So Tzarech Gadol is going to be over here an issue. They might be Nisa Darabanan, they might not, but to be Matirit, we're going to be able to be Matirit anyway. So, the fact that the Ubar is 40 days or less, does that help us with Tay-Sachs or Down syndrome or that issue? So, it's not Ritzicha, I don't need a Rodef, so it might be different. Now, what could be Matir, these different Yisurim that are left? All I need is what? So for this one, for Chaval Zayim, I just need Refuah. For Ashkata Zera, I might need Pikoach Nefesh, or Peru Revu. For Hatzala, can anything overturn that? No, I'm stuck in Pikoach Nefesh. For this reason, even though Rav Moshe is going to say there's no necessarily Ritzicha, he's still Machmir, even below 40 days. Others start to get in. Other people that were machmir above 40, right? The Achiezer, the Nod Behuda, there's other achron that come in and seem to see this 40-day mark as more of a reason to be makil, and they start to certainly see in cases of Pikoach Nefesh, or I think Rosh Shlomo Zalman, even in the case of Tay-Sachs, if it's less than 40 days, will be makil on that issue. What about embryonic stem cell research and pre-implantation selection? What we really wanted to get at. Does that, what category does that fit in? Right? We're talking about, in our cycle there, the stem cells are way before implantation, right? They're way before 40 days. So certainly any cooler should apply. Is there anything else in the realm of stem cell research and pre-implantation selection that might even put it into a further makil category? Answer, yes, because it's not implanted in the uterus. The fact that these stem cells are not implanted in the uterus throws in a further level of kula, because now many, many poskim view the viability of this embryo as suspect, because once if it's less than 40 days but in a uterus, it has a good chance of growing up and surviving. But the majority, let's say, of IVF embryos that are not in the uterus yet will not make it. The vast, vast majority are not. Rove are not viable. And that has a big effect on the ultimate way of viewing them, the halacha. So all this was talking about less than 40 days, but in the mother, in the uterus. The final category, less than 40 days and not in the uterus. Is there a tzicha? No. Is there chavala to anybody? Not in the uterus.
Still the mother.
No, there's no aim anymore. So there's no chavala anymore. That's a biggie. There's no mother involved. And there's no chavalah to the vlad, like there wasn't in anyone less than 40 days. What about Hashkata Zera? That's going to be the one, right? That makes it all the way through. And we're going to still have to see, these will be the only matis, right? Is there a Din Hatzala? So here's where Rav Vosner, who's the one who came out with the Psak, drew the line. He says, what's our litmus test for Hatzala? Chilul Shabbos. So Rav Vosner paskin, you cannot be Machal Shabbos for the in vitro embryos or embryos that are not inside the mother. While you can be, if it was in the uterus, big nafkamina, outside the uterus, an embryo is just not viable enough. It's too much of a suffix, right? Therefore, no Chilul Shabbos, no Din Hatzala. At the end of the day, the only issue left for those is this in Hashkat Zera or not, which itself is a machlokes, but it affects the psak. So now, let's just finally finish up with those cases. We have a case of a in vitro fertilization, right? Can I do in vitro fertilization if I know I'm going to end up with embryos that are going to have to be discarded? Okay, well, what's the issur involved in discarding those extra embryos? The issur is, well, possibly, is it for Peru Revu? Yes, so I can do in vitro on that basis. Okay, Now I have in vitro products. What should I do with them? What can I do with them? Well, can I do research on them? Can I use them? Why? Well, so that's a good question. Is it pikuach nefesh? Is research pikuach nefesh? We're going to get into this when we do the next topic, but research is going to not be considered pikuach nefesh. It's too far away. We'll explain why. It's got to be a full beduka. It's all a bunch of criteria for making a pikuach nefesh. But what it depends on the alternative. And here's why the RCA came out saying it's okay. These embryos that are left after IVF, what is going to be done with them? So, if they're not going to be used, they're going to be discarded and destroyed anyway. Better to use them for research than to have them be discarded. So they allow them to do it. What about the case of a family that needs to create IVF embryos and then pre-select the good one? Can I allow them to do this even though it will result in them destroying the non-used embryos? Are we being Mekayim? Yes? Yes, we are. So, Rav Shlomo Zalman, Rav Eliyashiv, both came out in different cases allowing that very process to take place. What they allow, I'll tell you the specific cases, and we see how it applies specifically. And, we'll stop with this. Rav Shlomo Zalman was asked the following shot. Somebody wants to pick, they want to do in vitro and then just use the sperm that will create a male child and not a female child. Where they want to create these embryos and just pick the boys to survive and get rid of the girls. Can they do that? Just for the preference of a boy or a girl, he said, unequivocally not. Right? You're still possibly doing Hashpata Zera. For what purpose? Because you'd rather have a boy than a girl? That's not Pekuch Nefesh, and that's not Pekuch. What about if there's hemophilia in the family? That was the second question he asked. Hemophilia is a sex-linked disease. Meaning, in this time, if I choose a boy, I am protecting the child from getting hemophilia. Right? So, if I choose a boy to get rid of, and I leave it, the girls won't have it. So, for that purpose, to protect against hemophilia, and successfully have crew of a healthy baby, he allowed them to pre-select that particular embryo and discard the others, because it was all part of this heter. And Rav Eliyashiv had a case of people that were having this congenital disease called neurofibromatosis, and he said that they can also pre-select out those in order to be Mekayim Peru Avu. Where many of the poskim draw the line is they won't allow people to have many, many children, right? They really hold it to the mitzvah d'oraisa Peru Avu. They want you to be Mekayim, right? In its basic sense, the mitzvah of Peru Avu. It wouldn't, I think, allow somebody to just continue doing this once they've been Mekayim that mitzvah. Because then you don't necessarily have some pashut the heter of being Dochel Hashkata Zera.
In the first case, which was Amen, where they asked them about to choose in the second,
just,
if they already had a boy, they kind of tried to get a girl, vice versa, they already fulfilled half the mitzvah month, and let's say you're assuming the mitzvah for who's the one girl.
Right,
so
just to be
mentioned. And you kind of mitzvah like choosing one of the seven.
Right, so I guess if it were a case, and I don't know that he was asked this, but the setting there wasn't where they were like, if someone needs IVF anyway, that would be a good question. Need IVF anyway, and I want to make sure that I'm kind of mitzvah for Rebu. Can I now just make sure it works out that I get a boy or girl? Yeah, there might be room for a hetter on that based on this. Exactly. Then we won't have to worry about Shvata Zera. All we're doing is then destroying non-uterine pre-embryos. The only issue left is that if it's more Peru Avu, there might be more. That wasn't the case he was dealing with. He was dealing with more the extravagant case of somebody who just wanted to do it. All right, kind of rushed through all that at the end, but the take-home message I was trying to give is once you have the five shittos down, you could really work out the cases, right? Once you look for what would be matir, each of these is Syrian or not, and then you could work out exactly where you have leverage and where you don't. And the differences in the poskim, are really based on these shittos to begin with the whole Indian of abortion.
What we haven't done is the issue of fetal intervention, which raises other issues unrelated to abortion. Baruch Hashem, I don't know about you, but I don't want to take another week on abortion. Other issues such as taking risks and the issue of pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh is a very underrated issue. What exactly counts as pikuach nefesh? Right? Many people overuse it, and many other people underuse it. So it's important to have parameters of exactly what pikuach nefesh is, what really constitutes. Something like research, almost the Chuliyama would not constitute pikuach nefesh, even if it's for great life-saving work. Right? Did you ever hear of anybody who wanted to do research on Shabbos, right? No, there's good reason. Why not? We'll see. They're very violent. They're very easy to understand the chorus for the fact that it's not. But next week I won't be here. I apologize. But in the following week, we should take off the issue of fetal intervention and get into risk-taking, taking risks for other people, taking risks for yourself, and the issue of pikuach nefesh and experimental therapy. And we'll also touch upon making decisions for others. Parents making life and death decisions for children and a lot of decisions for children. How much leeway do they have to overrule, let's say, a medical opinion? Right? The guardian, the apotropos of their child, does that give them the right to make a decision for a child? Right? In the secular community, the parents have all the power. Doesn't matter what the doctor says. If the parents want a certain treatment, it gets done. If they want to not have that treatment, even if the doctor's telling them it's in the best interest of the child, unless you have a reason to take them to court and you think it's modest child abuse, they have the power. What does halacha have to say about that? Not so partial. Halacha would not agree with it. That's the short answer. All right. Thank you for the extra time.
Could I, as a Jewish, not Jewish babies,